Good afternoon, everybody. First, I'd like to thank Alex and Maria for giving us the invitation to present some of the work that we're doing in the Gore Lab. Luckily, I had Kelly Thorpe and Ivan go before me. I will be touching on both their projects. And although Kelly left, the stuff he talked about today, I mean, people with that kind of skill set are worth their weight in gold. They really make my job a lot easier. And so today, I just want to talk about how we're actually using this high-throughput phenotype data to actually look at the underlying genetics of abiotic stress tolerance, and we are using cotton as kind of the model organism for that. And so currently I would say the challenge in modern plant biology is understanding how discrete DNA base pair information is translated into dynamic phenotypes. In this diagram, you'll see on the left-hand side that the genotype space is essentially like a 2D representation. But in reality, well, we get our phenotypes like this in phenotypic plasticity. And trying to understand how that arises and what environmental factors give rise to that is really critical in terms of developing stress-resilient crops to deal with, you know, climate change and a lot of the factors we're seeing come up in terms of agricultural production. And so initially, you know, we focused a lot on genotyping, and I would argue that at this point we've really got that nailed, especially with whole genome sequencing coming along. And then more along the lines of that, you know, the need for high-throughput phenotyping has really been realized. And so it's kind of, how do we marriage these two, you know, data sources together to, you know, really solve the problems of plant breeding? And so one of those problems is that sustainable agriculture is threatened by increasingly variable weather patterns, diminishing freshwater resources. Those resources that exist, there's fierce competition for them. Nowhere else is this more true than in cotton production. You'll see that the cotton belt runs along the southern part of the U.S. Unfortunately, this area is also prone to drought. This is taken from 2011, and during this year, just the state of Texas alone saw an economic loss of $2.2 billion and a record 55% of acreage just abandoned in the field. So this kind of puts a number to, you know, how important developing stress-resilient crops are. Unfortunately, the global data supports the same pattern in other cotton-producing regions, but pick any crop you want. This problem is imminent. It's going to impact us, especially with an increasing population. And so the real challenge is, in fact, developing, you know, drought and heat stress tolerant varieties that can cope with this. And so one of the ways that we think that we can do this is capitalizing on the information that we can gain through high-throughput through phenotyping and, you know, leveraging these types of technologies to elucidate the genetic elements responsible for these traits. And so today I'm going to be mainly talking about one experiment that was conducted here, or just south of here in Maricopa, Arizona, Alex's favorite place in the U.S. The population we're talking about is a 95 recombinant inbred lion population. The real key to this environment, though, was that it was a managed stress. So as you all know, it's hot and sunny in Arizona, I think just about all the time. I don't think it rains that much. And so for this work, it was really ideal because we had this very precise drip irrigation system where we could actually use crop evapotranspiration models to appropriately adjust the amount of available moisture for our two different treatments. And so with this, we were able to have a wet and a dry treatment, and the dry treatment received 50% of the daily evapotranspiration rate, so whatever that calculated imbalance was. And then looking towards the phenotypes that we're collecting, specifically I'm just going to talk about the field-based high-throughput phenotyping, which we measured canopy temperature, NDVI, and plant height at multiple times during a day as well as days throughout the year. And then the second part of my talk, I'm going to talk about ionomic profiling and address some of those issues that Ivan raised during his talk. Kelly already showed you, he showed you the cool fancy one, like version 2.0. This was the original. I would even call it the beta version. Somewhat crude, but it did get the job done. You know, Kelly already talked about the sensors that it carried. The real key component in terms of processing this type of data that I don't think he highlighted was having this RPK GPS. This allows us to tie back data points to individual plants almost. And so with this system, even this older version, we could do 450 plots in 30 minutes. And for the type of data we're collecting, that's fairly impressive considering that if you had an undergraduate with an infrared gun out there taking canopy temperature, it would just wasn't ever going to get done. And the machine never complains, so that's also a benefit. I just want to make a quick note about what it is we're trying to do, like, in the field in terms of quantification of in-field stress response. So it's important to remember that what we're measuring is the plant's response to the stress, not the stress itself. With that being said, that's why I put so much emphasis on saying that Maricopa was a favorable location, because we know exactly what stress we were applying in the field, because for traits like canopy temperature, it's just like if you go to the doctor. They're going to take your temperature, and all they'll tell you is you're sick. You don't know if you have a common cold if you have sepsis and might die in 72 hours. It's kind of the same thing with canopy temperature in terms of plants. Heat and drought obviously elicit this response, but so does like a bacterial wilt. And so it's just key to know what exactly is occurring in the field. And so the three traits that we're focusing on are canopy temperature, NDVI. We're using NDVI not as you're probably familiar with in terms of biomass estimation. We're using it to quantify how the actual geometry of the canopy is changing. In this photo over here, you can see that about 1 o'clock, the cotton plants are pretty cooked, and their leaves are just drooping. Because of that change in the canopy architecture, that changes how much light's being reflected off of it. Thus, we can capture that with NDVI. And then finally, we had canopy height. And using that data in conjunction with NDVI, we can estimate leaf area index to give us a whole plant response. And I would kind of stress, and I'm glad Ivan talked about this, that these types of technology kind of give us the ability to do longitudinal assessment of phenotypes over the course of the season, and in our case, over the course of the day as well. So in context of our experiment, data collection began at flowering and continued all the way through the final development of the cotton plant. The drought treatment itself was not imposed until flowering, because we didn't want to have any confounding effects of drought on phenology. And so when we look at the actual data that was generated after Kelly's done all his magic wizardry, what we see is that there's a differential time by treatment interaction that's kind of driven with each trait respective to the abiotic stress and how it responds to it. So obviously for canopy height, we do not expect cotton plants to grow or shrink over the course of a day. Now with NDVI, I don't know if there was as much certainty about whether or not we'd be able to capture that signal in terms of change in the geometry of the canopy. But lo and behold, we were able to. You see about 10 a.m., it's decreased a little bit, but by 1 o'clock, now it's thoroughly getting cooked, and the values are quite low. And then finally, canopy temperature, one of the most responsive traits. At 7 a.m. in the morning, there's no significant difference between the two treatments, but by 1 p.m., you know, there's a 10-degree difference. The plants that are in the dry treatment are obviously suffering pretty bad. And, you know, obviously, when canopy temperature was first shown, I mean, you've seen these graphs before. And I would stress that the individual time point measurements aren't what we're after. What we're after, and what's so important about hydrophytic phenotyping, quite frankly, what's cool about it, is we're able to estimate this change over time. And so using a mixed model, Ivan, this is how we're getting around the time component, by incorporating it. And so our new phenotype is not the time point estimates, but is essentially the slope. And that's really what we want to know, is how do plants differentially respond to abiotic stress in the field. And so this particular day was one of the hottest that we experienced during the course of the experiment, but we also wanted to see that, yes, in fact, we were observing this kind of differential response throughout the development of the plant to make sure that it was consistent when we actually did the data analysis. And sure enough, you know, we can see that even within the three distinct growing stages, we are seeing the same type of response. I apologize, I reoriented the graph, so now the time is across the top. But the key thing is there that it's consistent. And so when we get deeper into looking at canopy temperature measurements, and we look at the growth stages, we see this fact that within growth stages, the canopy temperature values are more correlated than across. And we see a significant drop in the values as you go from one stage to the next. First of all, this is important because it kind of provides impetus for why you need continued phenotyping throughout the course of the season, that no one time point really captures what's occurring in the field. The other thing that's important is that it kind of gives us an idea that the hydrophytic phenotyping platform is actually capturing some type of biological signal. I think we have to be wary about the ability to generate data is so easy now. And we have to ask ourselves, are we generating just data, just numbers, or are we generating actual information? And so that's kind of one of the key things about this whole project, was trying to really prove that what this platform is getting is actual biology, not just numbers. And so taking that slope for each of those genotypes across the time and day, We performed a QTL mapping, and I realize this graph is quite painful to see on an overhead projector. I apologize for that. But just let me explain real quick. Along the x-axis, we have the markers along the chromosome. On the right-hand side are the individual years. And then on the left-hand side are the days of the year, or excuse me, the individual days within a given year. And then if you see red, that means that the allele increased the canopy temperature, and if you see blue, it means it decreased it. And so one of the best things, and most, I guess, exciting things that came out of this analysis was that we were able to identify QTL that had distinct temporal expression patterns, i.e., just like what Ivan showed. They didn't just come on any time. They came on at specific times. Specifically, it was bull development and elongation. And, you know, this is kind of critical because empirically, you know, we haven't necessarily shown this in the field so much, but I think we can all agree that in our mind, when a seed, you know, germinates, not all the genes are turned on for the entirety of its life. And so for the first time, we can kind of really get at what is the interplay between genetic expression and the environment, as well as phenology. And so in addition to these canopy traits, we also did two other traits, well, addition to about 30 other traits, but two specific ones are abscisic acid content and carbon isotope discrimination. These are two hallmark traits when investigating stress physiology, as it gives you an idea of plant water balance, how the plant is actually regulating its stomata. And so we performed the mapping for those two. And sure enough, they co-located with our canopy temperature QTL. So that was a good result. And sometimes I guess that saying, you know, you'd rather be lucky than good. About a week after I finished this, they published the cotton genome. And so we were able to take our QTL intervals and blast those. And I know that taking a QTL interval and blasting it, you can find your favorite gene. But given that, you know, there was a minimal annotation for the genome at this time, we were able to hit, for carbon isotope discrimination, a Droitwich-Franz family protein. Then for abscisic acid, we were in fact able to find the binding element. So the actual thing that's controlling the genetic expression. So we were really excited about this because now we can show that the phenotyping platform, that what we're measuring, what we're capturing, is true biology, that we're not just generating QTLs and p-values to show you guys. That there is biology here, and that's what's so critical. But realistically, I think going forward, high-throughput phenotyping kind of elucidates the fact that it's genotype by environment by time, and that the ability to phenotype trait development over the course of the growing season is that phenotypic development, trait development, is the new phenotype that we should begin looking at. And so, you know, we have these three lines, and basically I'm just trying to show that, you know, genotypes achieve a final endpoint and yield based on different mechanisms. But in the context when you think about precision breeding and what it is we're trying to do, this is where it becomes important to know that we want to have the right QTL at the right time in the right environment. And especially when you consider things like environment and precipitation, where these things are becoming the limiting factors. I mean, we already have the alleles. We know what germplasm to use, what lines is harboring the alleles. It's combining them in a time-dependent fashion. And I think this is where the real power is, and why I was really excited to see Ivan's work in terms of, you know, starting to look at the temporal component. So, building on that, going back to this first slide, you know, I would say that we need a revised model in terms of what phenotype development is. You know, and I don't know if we need the second order or the primary interaction, but the biggest thing is this, the G by E by T. And the idea of that we have to start incorporating time into our models. And so the next thing I think that as a community we need to spend some time or give some thought to is actually the E in our equation. And understanding, because, you know, we're getting good at the genotyping. The phenotyping technology is amazing now. But nobody does really that much detailed characterization of the environment. And that's a shame because ultimately the environment is what's really driving the phenotypic plasticity, because plants being festal organisms, they have to modulate what gene expression is occurring to achieve the phenotype they need. And so I just want to give a quick plug for envirotyping. And basically, that quantifying the environment is critical to understanding trait formation. Envirotyping is a new typing, I guess. Where detailed information, you know, is characterization, it's at the same scale and accuracy that we're collecting our phenotype data. And these are things like soil properties, climate, companion organisms in terms of weeds, insects. And why this is important is because, just like in the cotton work, it provides the context in which to evaluate the QTL expression. And the best part about all of this is that, for the most part, the technology is already available, it's already fairly robust, and it's not that expensive. In one case, you know, we're able to develop these in-field sensors that can be wirelessly connected for data collection in real time. And I'll just point out four quick examples. I'm sure most of you have seen the watchdog. I saw one creep up in the background of one of Ivan's slides. The soil neutron probes that we talk about, EM38 mapping for soil conductivity, which measures soil water holding capacity. But these are kind of the next generation. Just relying on these cheap open source Raspberry Pis, Arduinos, and people are making some remarkable sensors. This one costs $190, it's probably cheaper now, and it takes soil temperatures at four depths. It can take canopy temperature, precipitation, all the atmospheric information that you would want, and with some, tricks, I don't want to call them tricks, but you can connect them into a wireless network, and this would almost give you envirotyping at the plot scale. And so when we start thinking about collecting that kind of density of data on our phenotypes, I think we should give it some focus on terms of what the actual environment is. And so, kind of building on that, one project that we're working on is, you know, incorporating the soil environment into our ionomics analysis. And so, luckily, Ivan already introduced this quite well. And so, two specific questions we have is, how does water deficit, how does our treatment irrigation impact the ionome? Because osmoregulation is affected by ions like calcium, magnesium that regulate the guard cells and drive stomatal aperture, along with ABA. But also, how does the actual soil environment impact the ionome? Are plants able to, you know, modulate their interaction with the environment? Because as Ivan pointed out again, you know, they're getting most of their nutrients through the soil, getting uptaken and put into the seed. And so I don't think I'd have to convince many of you that the soil environment is, you know, fairly heterogeneous. On the left is an image of EM38 mapping. So just to go over the colors, if the box is blue, that means the cotton plant within that is taller than, is a taller plant. And basically, if it's red, it means it's shorter. The background color, if it's red in the background like that, that means it has low water holding capacity. If it's blue, it means it has high. And so this is the same type of drought experiment where you have irrigated, non-irrigated, irrigated, non-irrigated. And you'll see down here in these last two that even though it's irrigated, the lack of that soil holding capacity is adversely impacting the plant height. And then on the right-hand side, we've taken the data that Ivan's generated for us in terms of soil analyses and profiling ionomic elements. And this is just for calcium. And so we're able to actually model calcium content within the field and interpolate the surface. Using that information, we can create and we can pull out plot-level estimates of the calcium, which we are now able to incorporate into our model. Some people have made the argument that, you know, we don't really need this data. We have spatial models like ARMA or autoregressive that we can handle this. But I would just put forth the argument that, yes, we can use those models to remove that variation, but that doesn't mean we understand it. And at this point, I think, you know, we have the capability to really go beyond just removing variation from our data sets and actually trying to figure out what's driving that variability. And so on the left-hand side, I did the analysis in terms of which ions had a significant relationship between the soil and the seed concentration. And of 14, only these four did. And at first I was kind of heartbroken because I was like, man, I really hope there's a good relationship. That would be really cool. And then we kind of started thinking about it, and then when we looked at the seed ions that had a significant treatment effect in terms of irrigation, we see that magnesium shows up for both. And we began thinking about this in the terms of, if we didn't have the soil data, we wouldn't know that the treatment effect that we're seeing for magnesium is actually due to irrigation so much as it is just local soil variability. So by having this next level of data, we're better able to handle the actual biology. And when we think about genetic mapping, it's now we know that our phenotypic variability is due to genetics and not localized soil variability. And I would posit that this would hold true for most of the traits that we would measure in the field anyway, like canopy temperature. And so just thinking ahead, I just really like to stress the importance of what this type of integration of data can do. And so to address kind of Ivan was talking about again was this the cotton-ionome is phenotypically and genotypically highly interrelated. If you look at the PCA of just the phenotypic data, I mean, boy, everything correlates with everything, essentially. Maybe not so much potassium and arsenic. And so then there's the question of, is this just being driven by the environment? Is it due to genetics? And so now we look at the genetic correlations, and we can see that, you know, pretty much everything's related to everything. And this makes sense when we think about ion transport within the plant. Whether it's active or passive, the channels that are moving ions most likely can move more than just one. And so that's probably what's most likely driving this this observation. And so when we think about this and think about the ways in which we want to elucidate the genetics of these traits, it's how do we perform the actual mapping? And again, when we looked at this, I performed the QTL mapping just using univariate methods, standard inclusive composite interval mapping. I tried dimensional reduction like PCA, hierarchical clustering, and you know, it just, that's kind of where we're at. So we were like, well, let's try something new. So we reached out to Dr. Min Xing at Purdue University, and she had a multivariate Bayesian classification method. And so this model is actually able to fit all of our markers at one time instead of doing just a simple interval mapping, and we're hoping that maybe this would give us some increased power. And I apologize for putting the results in such less than palatable form, but I just got these Tuesday, so you're just going to get the overview because I can't state with confidence yet what we have. And so we just look at the univariate. We have about 30 QTL, and we have those two shared QTL regions, and what I mean by this is that iron and nickel would map to the same chromosome. So we see that happen twice. When we look at the Bayesian methodology, we see there's 38 QTL, slightly a little bit more, but the more important factor is that seven have shared QTL regions. And before the meeting, Ivan and I were looking at the data itself, and a lot of the pairings seem to make biological sense. But there's still this idea of reconciling univariate and the Bayesian and, you know, what's right. What performs, you know, what gives us the better answers that we want. And so we're still kind of working through that. And the methods are complementary. I mean, we do have shared QTL between two of the two approaches. There are, evidence of large additive effects in terms of gene by gene. And also very exciting is that a portion of our QTL co-located with our canopy temperature, NDVI, or stress physiology traits. So now we have a way to kind of integrate our two different data sets and understanding the actual biology of how cotton responds to drought and heat stress. And currently, we are working on a partial least squares implementation with Dr. Bruce Weir. And so, again, we come back to a slide, and we have this great long equation. And at this point, we've talked about phenotyping, genotyping, and virotyping. And it's kind of this idea of what's the framework in which to combine all this information. And I don't know if how many of you were able to make this morning's symposium with Mark Cooper, Natalia De Leon, and Mark Sorrell, sorry. But one of the answers that keeps coming up is crop modeling. And, you know, I guess I'll just pay it lip service for a little couple slides. It really represents kind of an integration of information in that we can combine genotypes, phenotypes, and envirotypes kind of into one framework to try to understand what exactly is happening in the field and what's driving our phenotypes. And so up to this point, I would say that most of our models are quite linear. We're really good at fitting linear models to biological phenomena, even though we know biology isn't linear. And so by incorporating a crop growth model, we're kind of trying to get over that because we know crop growth is not additive. And so that's kind of one of the attractive features about this. And more importantly, crop growth models represent a functional relationship between the actual physiology, the genetics, and the environment. It's not just a static, you know, simple linear model. And so when we look at these components, you know, we're starting to fill in all the relevant pieces that we need in terms of environmental parameters, in terms of like radiation, rainfall, you know, what the actual temperature is, the derived phenotypes down here. And I think one of the critical components that we're kind of starting to bring online is the idea that hyperphenotyping can kind of fill in the middle. By having that longitudinal assessment, we can actually begin to model the crop development, fit that logistic curve to like plant height. And so that way, you know, we can look at parameters like leaf initiation rate, leaf appearance rate, kind of root elongation, and try to measure those types of parameters. And by solving, you know, we can look at floral initiation, kind of total leaf number, and these growth parameters. And these growth parameters might be the phenotypes that we're really interested in. I mean, I think we've beat plant height to death for most crops, and I think it's probably time to see, you know, what's actually interacting at the molecular level to give rise to these phenotypes. And so I'll just kind of close out with this one figure, which I think kind of ties all these relevant things together. We have genotype information, so I would say we've kind of got that one squared away. The envirotyping, I think I can probably convince most of you that this is fairly, we can do this. We don't have to spend a lot of investment. Understanding G by E, well, that's still hard, but I think we're getting there. All these things kind of intersect to give us the phenotype, and it's using field-based high-throughput phenotyping or any high-throughput phenotyping method in general, allows us to make some type of connection between crop models and genomic models. And so, again, what we want to do with the crop models is estimate these type of growth parameters, use them as new phenotypes. If we can fit a logistic curve, essentially, to plant growth, we can perform QTL mapping on a continuous basis, or GWAS, pick your favorite, and we can actually monitor that QTL expression. Again, it's about having the right gene at the right time in the right environment. And so I think the marriage of these two ideas and, you know, connecting these models is really where we want to go in terms of developing model phenotypes. So now, in terms of genomic selection, now we can predict genotypes in untested environments because we know how the genetics respond to the environment. And that, I think, is where the real power is. And I think in 10 years, you know, I think everything, all the component pieces will be together. So just to summarize, I think that high-throughput phenotyping adds this additional dimension to our data set, which is time. And that, you know, our ability to understand trait development in relation to phenology and environmental variability is going to be critical when we think about addressing the issues that we're trying to seek in terms of stress resiliency for our crops. Again, you know, the genetic mapping on a continuous scale to kind of understand QTL expression. I call it dense phenotyping in environmental conditions. I really think this one is easy for us to do. The crop growth models, I do put this in italics. Scott, just so you're aware. it may provide the framework that we're looking for. You know, the results that Mark Cooper showed this morning looked highly encouraging. And so I think this will be a very valuable tool that we can use to really leverage our information and get the most out of it. And then finally, you know, looking at genomic selection, you know, being able to predict phenotype across diverse environments will be critical. Some remaining challenges is the exploration of time series models. I'm not so sure we need to spend a bunch of time trying to develop new ones, but I think there is some relevancy in trying to understand what are the pitfalls of the already developed ones. Can those be used with our data? Are they adequate? Will they capture really what we want? And then I would echo what others have said in terms of the development of multivariate methods. Man, we beat PCA to death. I'm sorry, but like, you know, just like you said, Jesse, you get these PCA QTLs that show up and you're just left wondering and scratching your head, like, what do those even mean? And so I think that we need to have some type of effort, and maybe, especially for the stats guy, I mean, as imaging data comes along, it's going to be super imperative that we have something that can handle this. And as always, computational efficiency in terms of actually doing the calculations. I mean, if it takes 2 hours to transfer the data from Kelly's system, doing the math is going to be kind of hard. And so putting all these component pieces together, I would just like to stress that if we can do this, we have the ability to breed stress-resilient cultivars for precise environments, which I think as plant breeders, that is ultimately the goal, and that is how, you know, you provide nutritious food for a growing population in the time of climactic change. And so with that, I would take any questions, and I thank you for your time.